This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are about to have a conversation with Scott Horton, who's a law professor at Columbia University and associate editor of Harper's Magazine. He wrote this piece in Harper's, a cover story, The Guantanamo Suicides, A Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle, which has not gotten a lot of coverage with a lot of media, though some. We'll talk about that later in the conversation. But we want to outline this really incredible breaking story that Scott Horton did. He's with us now. And, Scott, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Tell us how, A, you got involved in the story, and, B, kind of broadly outline it for us.
Well, I got involved going back about a year now. I was looking at the reports that came out of these deaths in detention. And in this particular case, these three people dying at the same time grabbed headlines all across the United States and all around the world, really. The Bush administration said that these three prisoners had committed suicide as an act of asymmetrical warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And they went on to describe them as hardened Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters, as vicious killers. And in fact, one press officer for Secretary Rumsfeld said that these people were like the Nazis who were tried at Nuremberg. So that got quite a splash of attention. And the military was very tight-lipped about exactly how they died. It refused to release any specific information, just saying that they were found hanging in their cells. Jump forwards, roughly 2 years later, the Washington Post got its hands on a declassified military intelligence evaluation from which we learned all of a sudden that all of these three men had in fact been cleared of any suspicion of being involved with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Military intelligence had determined that there was really no evidence whatsoever that tied them to any involvement with these terrorist organizations. And in fact, we also learned that they were all basically ready to be released. Two had been released in 19 days at the time he died. Another was in line to be released right behind him. And the third was a Yemeni, and he was only being held back from release by the fact that there were bad diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Yemen. So about a year ago, I started collecting all this information, sort of looking very, very closely at the government's case, for calling this suicide and all the issues that surrounded it. And I was working with some students and faculty at Seton Hall who also had gotten the government documents and were going through them. And I think then, really, it's last November that we succeeded in piecing together in detail from FOIA documents what the government's theory was of their death. And that was really something shocking.
And well, as we get to the government's theory about these deaths, let's introduce to our listeners some key players in this story, starting with Army Staff Sergeant Joseph Hickman. And first of all, that makes our listeners, this is interesting, a little sidebar since we are producing this show from Maryland, that this is has a lot of Maryland implications. The soldiers involved in this are part of a National Guard unit stationed in Western Maryland, an intelligence and military police unit, of which Army Staff Sergeant Joseph Hickman was part of. So go ahead, Scott.
That's right. And in fact, the story ultimately, the lid gets blown off of the government's account as a result of information that's provided by soldiers from the 629th Military Intelligence Unit, which is based in Baltimore. And they're all soldiers originally from Maryland. And Joe Hickman, in fact, grew up in South Baltimore. And, talking to him, it's like he could take you through every billiard hall and diner that features in the movie Diner, for instance. But he's moved to Wisconsin now, so he's not living in Maryland anymore. This unit of Maryland soldiers were assigned to provide security at Camp Delta. They went down there in March of 2006 and came back to Maryland in 2007. And they were there on duty the night that these deaths occurred. And in fact, there's a group of about four of them who were the tower guards that night. And Sergeant Hickman was the sergeant of the guard on duty, who was responsible for monitoring everything that went on the camp and everything that passed in and out of it. And that's how this story gets broken open, because Sergeant Hickman, as sergeant of the guard, monitors and observes the removal of these three prisoners. prisoners from the camp in which they were being held that evening. He tracks it down minute by minute and watches exactly what they're taken to, which is a location located about a mile north of Camp Delta called Camp No. They're taken out there between 7 and 8 in the evening. Of course, all the autopsies say they died at roughly 10:30. They're returned back to the facility at 11:30, so pretty clear that they died while they were out at this facility. And that's the essence of the information that the Maryland Guardsmen had provided.
So, and then I'm going to come back to some of the things you said just said now and in your article and how you portrayed it in the article. But this other person who's central to the story is Colonel Michael Bumgarner, who you paint almost as an Apocalypse Now kind of Army figure. He made me think of the movie.
Yeah, or maybe MASH. He sort of fits in there, too.
Maybe so.
He has a great sense of humor, though, so he's not exactly all darkness and brooding.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldiers love him. They absolutely love him, even though there's been some conflict there.
Well, talk a bit about his role in this.
Well, he was the commander at Camp Delta, and he wasn't there the night that the events occurred. He was out at a party with Admiral Harris, who was the commander for the Gitmo base, and he came back only around 1 o'clock in the morning, after the bodies had been discovered. But he really plays in quite dramatically the next morning, because at 7 o'clock in the morning, he assembles all the guards in this open-air theater they have at Camp America and tells them, you all know that these prisoners died by swallowing rags, but you're going to hear the news reports, and the news reports are going to be different. The news reports are going to say that they committed suicide by hanging themselves in their cells. And then he ordered the people who are there, you're not to undercut this story in any way, not to deny it. You just keep quiet about what you saw and what you observed that evening. He issues that as an order to them, and he also tells them that that their own phone calls and emails are being monitored. So they better not disobey his instructions.
So, but I want to just now go to the just to give our listeners a sense of how you wrote about it and the horrors of what happened to how they were found and what happened to Salah Ahmed al-Salami and Yasser Talal al-Zarhani, who were from Saudi Arabia, and Mani Shaman al-Yutabi, who was from Yemen. And the way you describe, how the rags were stuffed down their throats, bags over their heads, one that had hands tied behind them, the other had hands tied behind them, one with their legs tied, and they're called a suicide. Let's start there, then I'm going to move into this autopsy. I just want to set up for our listeners, just exactly what happened here.
Well, let's start with the official claim, what the U.S. government claims happened to them. It claims that they somehow managed to get this massive amount of cloth, and they used it to weave bonds and ties and a noose, and also to put sheets over their cell walls, which were all wire mesh, so that people couldn't see in. And it describes them as binding their feet, binding their hands, stuffing rags down their mouths, and at least one case also putting a surgical mask over the face to hold the rags in place, fashioning a noose, tying the noose to the top of an 8-foot wire mesh wall, climbing up, while feet and hands are bound, climbing up on top of a wash basin, putting head through the noose, tightening the noose, and jumping off to commit suicide. And moreover, doing these things, three prisoners who cannot communicate with one another because they're in totally different cells, three prisoners doing these things simultaneously at exactly the same time. And, of course, this is astonishing because there is no reported case in the history of humanity of anyone ever committing suicide this way. It's astonishing. And when you think about it, why would someone do these things to commit suicide? So it's filled with horrible contradictions. Now, what we learned from the Maryland Guardsmen is that the three prisoners were removed from that cell block that evening, and they were taken by 8 o'clock in the evening to this facility called Camp No. and a van returning them brought them back about 11:30 in the evening, which will be, you know, an hour to maybe an hour and a half after they died, to the prisoner clinic. So that's the strong contradiction. So the Maryland Guardsmen are essentially telling us they didn't die there in that cell block. They died in this other place, and we don't know what happened to them. But we stumble across another fact, because that same evening, another prisoner, who's named Shakur Amar, is taken out and subjected to a very, very harsh interrogation process, which he then describes in the statement to his attorney. In fact, he says he thinks he's going to die that evening. He doesn't think he's going to come out alive. And he describes being brutally tortured and also having these same restraints put in his mouth, cloth put in his mouth to cover his windpipe, with a mask put on top of it. So it sounds exactly like what happens to the other prisoners. And these four people are tied together in something, in that they were four acknowledged leaders of a hunger strike at the camp. So it looks like one of them survived the ordeal and three did not.
And, of course, you also describe Shakur Amar as somebody who speaks fluent English, was about to become an English citizen when a British citizen when he was captured and taken to Guantanamo. Is still being held.
That's right. And the British government has been pressing very aggressively to get him back. And there's quite a campaign and stir in England about this. In fact, when my piece ran, it was headline grabbing account all across Britain, but not so much in the United States.
Yeah, we'll get to that. I really do want to talk about that. What's going on between here and the. There's often a huge difference from what we see in European press and American press. I'll get to that in a minute. But then we have this Sergeant Hickman, who was, as you say, was a warrior who went back to the Army after 2001, joined the National Guard after he already served, was named the, how would you describe, the NCO of...
Of the quarter at Guantanamo.
Left the service, moved to Wisconsin, and there's a lot of guys I know who served... who wrestle with things after they get out, could not live with what he thinks happened at Guantanamo, which is why he came out to talk to the attorneys who were originally doing this at Seton Hall, the guys who were originally doing the research, correct?
Yeah, that's roughly right. I would say he's had a long military career. He joined the service when Ronald Reagan was president. In fact, he went out of his way to tell me he thought Ronald Reagan was the greatest president of all time, and he really completely idolizes him. He was appointed to serve in Reagan's Presidential Guard, which is an assignment that's usually given to model soldiers. And he's won all sorts of medals and decorations, did really a wonderful job at Guantanamo, was promoted, was given medals. So, you know, certainly he's not someone who has a grudge, about what happened to him at Guantanamo. I mean, that was one of the high points of his career. But, you know, he is very, very concerned that he saw something that doesn't stack up with the official explanation. And he felt, because this was a case not involving prisoners being beaten, but involving, in fact, prisoners dying, that it was simply wrong for him to be quiet about it. It was very important that people know these facts, and he sat quietly about it and didn't say anything until he tells me January 20th he watched Barack Obama's inauguration and watched his inaugural address and heard what he had to say about torture and prisoner abuse. And then 2 days later he watched on television as Barack Obama was saying, "I'm going to close Guantanamo." And Hickman says, well, you know, he thought to himself, well, now the president has changed and the administration's attitude has changed, and now there's really no reason anymore why this should be secret, that people should know what happened.
We're talking to Scott Horton, who wrote the cover story, "The Guantanamo Suicides in quotes, Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle," in Harper's Magazine. He's a law professor at Columbia University and associate editor, correct, of Harper's Magazine.
Yes. Contributing editor.
I'm sorry. I didn't give you a full-time job there. Contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. So we're talking about the story he wrote about three men who were in Guantanamo, two Saudis and one Yemeni, who died at Guantanamo, rags stuffed down their throats, bound, called a suicide. People are questioning whether it is a suicide, which is the story of the crux of Scott Horton's piece in Guantanamo, in Harper's, called The Guantanamo Suicides. So here we have this retired staff sergeant, Joseph Hickman, who...
He's still active duty, actually.
Oh, I thought he was retired, the way you described it.
Not retired. No, okay. He's a recruiter now.
Okay, for the National Guard.
That's right.
Right. And so he's working with the folks at LaSalle who, and he's worried about any kind of he might have broken a law because he was told to keep quiet by Colonel Bumgarner and the others at the base, and so this investigation ensues now, with the lawyers, father and son at LaSalle at University, University Law School, and tell us of the sojourn that happened between the FBI. And the Department of Justice under our new Attorney General.
Well, of course, Sergeant Hickman wasn't sure what his legal obligations or rights were, so he went to some lawyers to advise him what to do about this. He thought he'd been placed under orders. He also felt he had a moral and the legal obligation to come forward and say what he saw. And he had never been contacted by the military investigators, nor had any of the outside guards been contacted by the military investigators and asked a word about what happened that night, another bizarre thing here. And the lawyers told him, you know, you should go to the Department of Justice about this. So they did. They had a meeting with the Department of Justice. In fact, the meeting they had was the day of Eric Holder's confirmation hearings. And within a couple of days, there was a team appointed to do an investigation. Well, then some very strange things happened. They basically didn't really do an investigation of any kind. At one point, the Justice Department attorney who was appointed to handle this, who had been one of the people involved in the preparation of the Justice Department's torture memoranda, by the way, tells the attorney for Sergeant Hickman that... Well, this investigation's over, and he says, why? And she says, well, because we can't find evidence that corroborates what Sergeant Hickman saw. And he points out to her, well, I actually know we gave you a long list of witnesses who would corroborate everything he saw, and we actually know, because we've talked to them, that you never contacted any of the witnesses who would corroborate. And she gets sort of frustrated for a minute. Oh, well, we have a little bit more work to do, and then it'll be over. So, in fact, they never conducted an investigation. They closed the case immediately. We don't know exactly what went on inside the Justice Department, but it's quite clear that the intelligence community told them to keep their nose out of the intelligence community's business. And that was the end of it.
And so you have, in the process of doing this article, also have spoken to a number of the families of the three men who were held at Guantanamo, and one of them, the father of one of the men, is a brigadier general in the Saudi police force who does not believe that his son committed suicide.
Absolutely. I have to say, the most impressive person I interviewed, and I interviewed 40 people roughly in connection with this article, was the father of al-Zarani, who's a general in the Saudi police, and he was just meticulous. I mean, you'd ask him a question and you'd get just a wealth of very detailed information in response, with citation to documents and specific witnesses and phone calls and everything. And he told me at the beginning he decided that he was not going to deal with this as the grieving father of his son who died. He was going to deal with this as a professional criminal investigator.
And they say that his son was taken when he was 17 years old.
That's right.
And his father, Talal al-Zarhani, disputes the fact that he was a member of al-Qaeda.
Well, he says absolutely untrue. And moreover, that's what our own military intelligence people concluded. It was absolutely untrue. He was not. He had nothing to do with the Taliban or al-Qaeda.
But you have no doubt about the veracity of al-Zarhani's father?
Absolutely not. I mean, of course, he states facts and he states opinions, you know, two different things. But everything he described to me as a fact, you know, was borne out as a fact. I mean, he described, he had a very detailed description of the body when he observed it. He says he saw clear evidence of of torture and abuse of the body, and moreover, the things he described match what I saw in the Shachar Amar description. I mean, it's the same sort of problems. A lot of these things were not remarked upon in the U.S. autopsy, which was heavily redacted. But then again, there was also an independent autopsy done in Switzerland of the Yemeni, and the doctors there were amazed at the number of things they observed on the body that were not reflected in the official U.S. autopsy. And the official U.S. autopsy was conducted by anonymous doctors. The government refuses to say who did this autopsy, or to release the full report, or to get release the autopsy photographs. They keep treating it as a hot secret.
And parts of the bodies were removed, as you write, that they removed the neck organs, the body parts, as you write, the larynx, the hyoid bone, the thyroid cartilage, which would have been essential, as you write, to determine whether they died from hanging or strangulation or from choking or something else.
That's right. And that's really one of the most shocking parts of this story. But let me back that up a little bit.
Yep.
It's not unusual for the medical examiner to remove this material.
I mean,
if somebody dies as a result of what the medical examiners call neck compression, which could be any of these things, strangulation, hanging, choking, etc., it's usual for them to take out this throat material and preserve it so it can be studied further for more tests and so on. But the unusual thing here is that the bodies were returned to the families for burial, and the families requested immediately a second autopsy to be conducted. And the doctors doing the second autopsy were immediately in contact with the military pathologists who had the throat material, saying, you know, we can't conclude an autopsy without the entire body. You've retained the most critical part of the body. Give it to us so we can examine it, or let us travel there to examine it in place. Now, the Pentagon stated when my article came out that these materials were not furnished to the families because the families never asked for them. And I was able to establish that's just a complete conscious lie. In fact, I published the letters where demand was made, records of phone conversations and email communications back and forth about it, and even the fact that the Armed Forces pathologist who was in charge, his name is Malik, said, you know, I would gladly assist you in this, but the government won't let me.
So let me ask this, come to why you think this is going on. I mean, this crosses two administrations. I mean, if in fact these men were murdered by our government while they're being held at Guantanamo, why do you think all this is being still, why do you think the lid is still on this case from the Department of Justice, from the Department of Defense? I mean, what do you think is going on?
Well, I think it's very clear that there was a cover-up in the Bush administration.
Right.
And I think it's equally clear that the Obama administration is acting on what President Obama has said repeatedly now, which is look forward, not back. That they do not want to open this up. They do not want to look at what's going on there. And that may be because they have a good sense of what it would turn up, and it would be too politically controversial, too politically difficult. Let me just suggest, first of all, we don't know how they died. We don't know in whose custody they died. It doesn't look like it was in the custody of the military, frankly. Looks pretty much like they died at a facility that was being operated by the intelligence community. And it looks like they died while they were being subjected to some pretty brutal treatment. Now, we know the Department of Justice itself was deeply involved in approving these torture techniques. There were a whole series of memoranda that were issued, okay? So if it turns out that a torture or restraint technique that had been authorized by the Justice Department led directly to their death, who's responsible? Well, it may not be, in fact, the government agents who are conducting the session. It may very well be the policymakers in Washington at very high levels who authorize this, who have criminal liability. And we also have something called the doctrine of command responsibility, a legal doctrine that applies in a very special circumstance. It applies when you have a prison camp being maintained in wartime. And this doctrine says, in those circumstances, if a death occurs, and it's a homicide, and the authorities in the camp don't prosecute the perpetrators, then legal liability for the homicide passes directly to the senior political figures who have responsibility for running that camp, which would be the Secretary of Defense and possibly even higher-up people. So because of that, the implications of that legal doctrine, that means if a criminal investigation led to prosecution, the prosecution could affect very prominent political figures. And it's extremely clear that Barack Obama and Eric Holder and his Justice Department do not want to go there.
What has been the response to your story from news organizations like National Public Radio, from the New York Times, from anybody who, and why you think they have not picked the story up and kind of pursued it with you?
Well, I've been on National Public Radio four times now, mm-hmm. discussing the story, so NPR was quite interested in it, but they doing it in the sort of discussion format, not doing independent reporting on it.
Like we're doing.
Exactly as you're
right.
doing. And
right.
likewise, and I also know from writers and editors inside the New York Times that they are looking at this story, trying to do their own reporting. But, you know, it took me half a year to write this story. I mean, you don't just snap your fingers
right.
and put it together. It takes a long time. I mean, they're working on it. I also know that ABC News is working on this story. And people, you know, who are involved in that effort have told me that they expect to have their story out shortly and that it will carry it another level. And beyond that, there are quite a few others, journalists who are writing and working on this. I'm proud to say I was up front in them, and I think I know when I was doing my research, I knew about other reporters who were doing research because people would tell me they had been contacted by this network news story or this newspaper and interview. But, you know, I think I was pretty far ahead of them on most of the points that I looked at.
We've been talking to Scott Horton, who is a law professor at Columbia University and contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, who wrote this really earth-shaking story, The Guantanamo Suicides, A Camp Delta Sergeant Blows the Whistle, which you can log on to on our website, steinershow.org, and link to that and all the other articles and pertinent material. And I want to thank our former producer, Jessica Phillips, for bringing the article to our attention. We look forward to following this in even greater detail. And I want to say, Scott Horton, thank you so much for bringing these things to light and spending the time with us today.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Kwame Kwe Arma is with us once again. He is in Baltimore because he's back at center stage. He's an actor and a playwright, singer, broadcaster, documentarian. I'll stop the list now so we can start the conversation. Many of you saw him for the first time, perhaps, in Baltimore with Almina's Kitchen. It was 2005. Is
2005, that's right.
A new play is coming up, and that is Let There Be Love, which we'll talk a bit about, that I read last night. And this coming Monday, after you hear this show, Kwame Kwe Arma and I will be on stage at Center Stage with a panel after he gives his talk, and we want you to join us there. We'll tell you more about that later on in this broadcast. And Kwame, welcome. Good to have you back, man.
Thank you, Mark. It's real fun to be back and great to see you.
Good to see you, too. You look great.
Thank you, sir. I'm trying.
So there's so many places to start here, and we'll kind of ease our way into the new play a bit. Mm. But I want to give a sense for our listeners who may for the first time be tuning in and just introducing themselves to you, and maybe
yes.
even to me, but to you in particular. To talk a bit about, I mean, you and where you come from, as an Afro-Caribbean Brit, one of a better term, right?
Yeah.
Talk a bit about where you grew up and where you came from to give us a sense of who you are.
Well, as you say, I was born in Britain, in London, in fact. And my parents hail from the West Indian island of Grenada, which features very much in my work. I love writing out of an Eastern Caribbean British sensibility. And we were born in, or I was born in Britain in the 70s, in the late 60s and into the 70s. And Britain then was a very cold place. You know, my parents were part of what we call the Windrush generation. It was a big exodus from the Caribbean to Great Britain, as requested by the British government to come and help rebuild Britain after the war.
Mm-hmm.
The racism and the
World War II, we're talking
World
about.
World War II,
right,
yes.
Right.
The racism and the xenophobia that they faced was phenomenal. And I often describe the Britain of the 70s and 80s into the 90s as being a very, very cold place. And I don't just mean the snow and the fog.
The literal British cold.
You know, the literal British cold. It was not, we grew up, or I grew up particularly in a time when we were not seen as being British, and often one was told, go back to where you come from. And I was never quite sure where that was, being born in Britain, and often, you'd go to the West Indies on holiday with your parents and they'd say, go home, you Englishman. And then you'd go to Africa and they'd say, hey, Bob Marley. You were never quite sure of quite who or where you were. I remember quite, at about 16, being very proud of describing myself to my then elder Rastafarian cousins as being a universal alien, and I'm glad to say that I no longer see that. But in fact, yeah, that was the kind of Britain I was born into, and I'm glad to say actually that Britain has warmed up significantly.
You mentioned Bob Marley. His birthday is coming up this week.
It is.
On the 6th.
It is indeed. I'm glad you know. Wow.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, we have a Marleyite household.
That's hilarious.
So what I was just interested is, I know that one of the things we're going to talk about on Monday has to do with social action, theater, and theater of the oppressed. One of the things I was really thinking about is your body of work, the plays I'm familiar with, things I've read, your columns you've written in the British newspapers, is this world of the African diaspora and the power that it has.
Yes.
And I wonder if you've ever thought about, and I kind of see kind of subtext sometimes and stuff you write, of the difference between the colonized who've gone to Britain, say West Africans, and those who come out of the societies that were not just colonized but enslaved,
yes,
and come to Britain, and the meeting of those two cultures.
Yes. I mean, it's a wonderful question, Mark, if I may say, and was probably the root of my third play in my triptych at the National called Statement of Regret. The first one was Elmina's Kitchen, the second was Fix Up, the third Statement of Regret. And yes, actually, I think that the kernel of that play was a call for reparations, not for the act of slavery, but for the act of deculturalization. And that, I think, was one of the differences between those who were colonized and those who were enslaved and colonized. There was a time as an African Caribbean, one could sit in any of the Caribbean islands, look to the left 200 years and only know slavery. Look to the right for 200 years and only see slavery coming. What that has done to the mind, that taking away of your language, taking away of your culture, that taking away of everything that is intuitively yours, and then superimposing the culture of the oppressor onto your mind and onto your psyche. The effects of that, which is slightly similar to that of the African American, the effects of that on the minds, on the spirit and the soul of that being, I think we are still seeing the ramifications of today. I think wherever you go in the world, you find a black version of the official language.
Right.
Whenever you go in the Western world, you know, be you France or Britain or America, there is almost an official black language. And part of that, for me, I think, is a longing to reclaim a natural tongue. To be speaking the first language, or your first language to be that of someone who once owned you, to, and to, is psychologically, there is a yearning to create something that is yours, mm-hmm. that is exclusively yours. So I think, yes, there is a difference. Not a difference where I say it should set us apart, but there is a difference in one's sense of one's contribution, really, to civilization, and one's contribution to one's own perception of self-esteem.
I mean, it seems to me in some ways that there's that we're just beginning to explore the African or African diasporic roots of Europe, yeah. and Europe.
Yes.
It really is just beginning. I mean, it's yes. come out of the Western Hemisphere clearly in a powerful way. Now that's just also really beginning to be honored in terms of its place.
Which, yes.
But in terms of Europe, it's really new, this kind of wrestling with whether it's this exhibit, by the way, is going to come at the Walters Art Museum here in Baltimore mm-hmm. Next year. It's called Africans in the Renaissance.
Yes.
You know, I mean, so there's a history here that we're now just beginning to kind of unearth.
Yes. I mean, there's in London, for instance, you know, we often people think about my parents' generation, the Windrush generation, as being the beginning of a large African community or a large black community in Britain, period. When in fact in 1789, one in four of the population of central London were in fact black. Many of them actually were Americans who had fought in the War of Independence on the side of the Brits, on the side of the Brits, and had gone to Britain. Many others had come from the Caribbean, some from Africa. One in four.
That's amazing,
I mean, it's a phenomenal, and one just has to go to the Old Bailey records to see it. One has to look at the edicts written by Elizabeth I about the plethora of blackamoors, as she called them, who were roaming around the streets of London that needed to be expelled, and that people you could like grab one and put one in a mental institution. I mean, that was so. Yes, you're absolutely right that actually Europe and Britain in particular was only just coming to terms with the notion that black presence and black contribution to its culture is not just contemporaneous, but actually is historical. And it goes back as far as one of the main trumpeters for Henry VIII was an African. And we look at the Roman Legion, and the Black Roman Legion that was there at the turn of the millennium. So actually, we're beginning to kind of investigate and to discover and to validate actually the Black British persona, not just contemporaneously, as I said, but historically.
I mean, it's interesting. To get a little side, but one of the things I learned from this exhibit coming to the Walters Art Museum is that de Medici's mother was African.
Yeah.
I mean, who even talks about the fact that we're talking about the Medici's being Afro-European
stock? Absolutely. I mean, one of the really interesting things is a wonderful book that came out a couple of years ago in Britain and Canada. It's called The Book of Negroes. Here, I think it's called Someone Knows My Name. Uh-huh. And it looks at Queen Charlotte, who was George III's wife. And I've actually seen the original paintings, and she looks, you know, she certainly looks as if she's got a lot of colour in her. Her comb was an Afro comb, the way her hair sits. And one of the things in this book, it talks about that this African woman looks at Queen Charlotte and says, oh, my God, you're an African. So, you know, and just the investigating things like that is fascinating, I think. We've not done it in Britain, as I've said before, and we're beginning now to really to get settled in the idea that black contribution to Britain is more than simply the slave trade.
We're talking with Kwame Kwe Arma, whose new play is coming to center stage. Let There Be Love. It opens, when does that happen? It's in February,
10th,
right?
Yeah, February 10th. 10th through till March 7th.
Is it in rehearsal now?
In rehearsal now, yeah.
Are you directing?
No, I'm not. Jeremy Cohen, a wonderful director, associate at Hartford Stage, is directing. And it's a joy. I came over for week one just to kind of, you know, to help with some table work. And Center Stage are brilliant. Whenever they do new plays, the idea is to have the play right there. And so I've just returned. I returned yesterday.
Are you doing rewrites as it goes on?
Rewrites I have been doing. Little words, little translation words I've been looking at. But on the whole, I'm really pleased that the story seems to transfer quite well into an American environment.
But the play is taking place where you set it.
Yeah, the play takes place in Britain, in London, right here and now, and is being done with, I mean, there are three characters in it.
Right.
One being played by the magnificent Avery Brooks, who is playing the lead character, Alfred. And in the story of the play, he's gifted a Polish cleaner, which has been played by Gretchen, who was in The Importance of Being Earnest.
Oh, right. We just played it.
It was just played, yeah, right, at Centre Stage, which is great. And his daughter. And so the three actors on stage are really investigating what it is to be an immigrant in a new country. But more importantly, what it is to pass the baton from one immigrant community to another. In Britain in the last 10 years or so, or less actually, there's been a huge influx of Polish and Eastern European people into Britain. And what was bizarre for me was I would begin to hear people who were of the last generation of immigrants saying, oh my God, these immigrants are coming into our country, taking our jobs, taking our housing, they need to be sent back. And that was, you know, that kind of amnesia, that kind of just shocked me. I was like, oh my God.
You mean people whose roots were in the Caribbean?
Yeah, people whose roots in the Caribbean, West Africa and Asia would be talking about these Eastern Europeans in the way that the indigenous Brits were speaking about them not but 20, 30 years ago. And that, Mark, shocked me. And I wanted to write something about it. I also wanted to write something that celebrated my, you know, the Windrush generation's contribution to Britain. And I think I said earlier that Britain was a very cold place, and they helped. The battles that they fought, both spiritually as well as physically, allowed Britain to be a warmer place for that next generation of immigrant to come in. The Polish, and one could say, yeah, it's partly because they're white, and yes, but also our country has sensitized itself to the plight of the immigrant, which has kind of made it slightly easier and has tempered the rage that invariably the working class and the underclass exhibit, and to new immigrants who they see as a threat, taking their jobs, taking their houses, not quite taking our women, but you know,
not yet.
I've not heard that one come up yet, but certainly the previous two. So I wanted to investigate that in Let There Be Love. I wanted to center have the lead character to be a xenophobic West Indian.
A crotchety old man.
Yeah, a crotchety old man, you know, kind of filled with the bile of having lived a disappointing life. And him taking that rage out on everyone. And into that world comes Maria, his Polish cleaner, and love begins. But not the kind of conventional love, you know, it's not a sexual love, but the love of a father who can hear a daughter's voice in her, who can see his ex-wife's pains in her. Someone who's willing to listen to his stories and understand that just because you are an elder, it doesn't mean that you are disposable and no longer of any interest. Someone who wants to listen to his wisdoms. And also added to that is Nat King Cole and the music of Nat King Cole. Which is why it's called Let There Be Love, after the song. Because actually, up until Maria arrived in his house, his only companion was Nat King Cole, the person he discussed things with and was led by. So, yeah, it's a four-hander, really. Those three and Nat King Cole.
Tell me, what's the derivation of Windrush generation?
The Windrush, it was in 1948. It was the name of the ship that brought the first 500 West Indians to Britain. And so hence stuck, for, of course, just to...
So that's
to,
right. I never know that, what... Okay.
That's yeah, right. That's why it... And it applies to all of those who came between 1948 and probably the mid-60s. After that, immigration really kind of fell off in that way. But during those 20 years or so, up to 500,000 African Caribbeans came to Britain. And kind of made a huge contribution.
So now, what is the percentage of Britain that's whose roots are African or West Indian?
Our ethnic minorities at the moment sit at about 8%. Our African and African Caribbean sit at about 3 to 4, I think. About 3%.
But larger in the cities.
In the cities, it's huge. So, for instance, my last play that was just on in London actually was based on the premise that London is 45% colour. And so, hence, should have a mayor of colour. Yeah, it is.
It is, right.
I mean, it's between 40 and 45.
Right.
And so, hence, should have a mayor of colour to represent it. In the cities, London, Birmingham, Manchester is the largest concentration of those of African and African Caribbeans. Glasgow is also huge in terms of Asians. In London, you cannot... I mean, London is hugely metropolitan. You cannot walk. And honestly, I mean, there are many parts of London that are simply colour. But if you walk into the centre of London, it's a 50-50 gig.
In the process of what you're doing here in Baltimore, I'm curious about what we're thinking about for Monday night.
Yes.
I mean, because you're not necessarily talking about the play.
No.
This is, you have something else in mind that has some more to do with theater, social action, the oppressed. What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm kind of doing a speech, of course, and you're moderating, which is brilliant, and we have a wonderful panel assembled. I suppose I see the artist as the fifth estate, and we have been kind of confined, I think, to the narrow bandwidth of entertainment on the whole,
right.
Or the higher echelons of high art have pushed so far away from social action that it just becomes a cerebral activity for the elite. And I think that actually the role of the artist is phenomenally important, I think, and I'll probably speak about this, that civilizations are judged and remembered through their arts. If I say Egypt, you think of the pyramids. If I say the Mayans, you think of, you know, if I can go on, literally every civilization, we define it. If I say Britain, actually, Britain is defined by its empire, but mainly by Shakespeare.
Right.
That we say, you know, it's our art.
The Irish
our
by
theaters.
Their playwrights. The,
correct.
You know,
I mean, literally the list, the Greeks. But I mean, I could go on and on and on. But in a kind of way, the modern artist has been defined by entertainment. And I think that our job has been, the artist in whichever form, to put a mirror up to society and say, do you like what you see? If you don't, what are you going to do about it? And in kind of way, when I first came to Baltimore, and 5 years ago with El Mida's Kitchen, I would say to friends in England, I'm off to Baltimore. They'd say, oh, where's that? And I'd kind of go, you know, it's a few miles from D.C., just below the Mason-Dixon, you know, 2.5 hours by train, Amtrak down to, from New York. And they would go, oh, great. Now when I say I'm going to Baltimore, they go, oh, my God, are you going to be safe? Are you going to be shot?
The
wire. Are you okay? Yes, the wire effect.
Right, right.
Now, I thought the wire was magnificent and brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely.
However... testament to my definition of the arts and cultures and civilizations, Baltimore has been defined by that art form.
That's right.
By the wire, as this corrupt place, ultimate corruption, or the Chicago of the modern age.
It was a mirror, a very powerful mirror.
A very powerful mirror.
Right.
And so on Monday, really, I want to say that if Baltimore has been defined through the art as this modern Chicago of the 1920s, if it has been defined as this place that is unsafe, what are the artists doing in order to regenerate its image of Baltimore? And that isn't to say that one should somehow negate David Simon's portrayal. But actually, I think that what I'm interested in is discussing what unique opportunity Baltimore now has, this place that is now known across the Western world. What opportunity does it bring? And I think it brings a wonderful opportunity for the arts to, and for the arts and society, to find a way in which to reinvent Baltimore for itself, for the nation, and for the world. And in a kind of way, the artists can play a wonderful role in that, reinvigorating and rebranding, actually, a city. When I go home, they say Baltimore, and I say, well, actually, no, I'm in Mount Vernon, and I love it up in Mount Vernon. You know, it's very cultured and wonderful. I go down to the New African American Museum down at War, and it's very cultured and very wonderful. I go, you know, and literally, I can talk about the many wonderful facets of Baltimore that no one else has heard. And in a kind of way, I think now is the opportunity to turn it around, to turn Baltimore's opportunity around, and use the arts in particular to solve some of the social problems that are abundant across the world. And mark Baltimore as a 21st century city, not one plagued by the 20th.
I like that. I mean, as you were speaking, I was thinking of all the numerous things that are going on that some of us try to give testament to, whether it's the young people from the Algebra Project who are now doing documentaries about all kinds of very serious issues and their life. And
I've seen them.
They're doing incredible work. And the arts has that kind of power that we don't think about, because we always think it is in the present. We think about it as something other.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with social reality.
Yeah.
It only has to do with something artistic that is separate from.
Correct. As art is a separate entity, and it is not, cannot be, never has been. It has just been made into a commodity that is vacuous and that is easily disposable. And I think it is the cry of every artist that I'm not just here to titillate today, but in fact, art is here to shape today and tomorrow and make comment and be remembered. It is a rememberer, a griot in the African tradition. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I just think that we face a time when I think Baltimore can lead the world. And again, I'll probably speak about it a little bit, but one looks at Dubai, which is actually falling into the very sand that it has created now. And going bust. But actually, one of the really interesting things that Dubai has tried to do, or did try to do, was to say, okay, we realize that we are this center where the skyscrapers are the biggest and everything is the greatest, but actually it is void of soul. What do? We get the greatest artist in to create a festival. So that actually those who are the reflectors, the rememberers, those who are the people who inject soul will now want to come to Dubai. It will be not just this place of vulgar commercialism, but will be a place of heart and a place of cerebral investigation. And all of a sudden, that I look at that and I go, you know, whoever it is that advised them is thinking correctly. You bring art to anywhere, it begins to live. There is already much art in Baltimore. How that art investigates and improves the lives of its citizens is the challenge.
I'm looking forward to Monday night.
I've just done my whole speech now, so
I got that. There's a great panel going to be part of this, and we're doing that Monday night, and your play opens on...
Yeah, on the 10th.
The 10th of February.
Yeah.
At Center Stage, Let There Be Love. And I can't wait to see that and sneak into a rehearsal or two and watch what's going on before we start.
I'm very excited. I directed it in London a couple of years ago. And, I am, and of course I'm not directing this one. And I have to say I'm terribly excited by this production.
Watching someone else do the directing, doing the work.
Yeah, doing the work. And the actors and the interpretation is just wonderful. I think Avery and the gang are going to move people.
They absolutely will. So join us Monday night. Kwame Kwe Arma will be at Center Stage at 7 p.m. And join us live on stage. Kwame Kwe Arma will begin the conversation. Then we'll have this great discussion together with you, the live audience there. And we also want you to join us for Let There Be Love. And all the information will be on our website, steinershow.org. And we will bring Kwame Kwe Arma back into the studio for another interview before we let him get out of Baltimore completely.
I can't wait.
Kwame, good to see you.
Thank you, Mark.
Take care, man.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Always.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman, and our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.